From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's interesting, fun, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
Our guest this morning is University of Utah Professor Roger Altizer. The Entertainment Arts and Engineering program at the University of Utah is a top-ranked program in video game education and research and is a national leader in the nascent discipline of games. The program's contributing to the definition of a new interdisciplinary informatics field that deeply integrates art, humanities, social science, and computational research and practice. We look forward to our conversation with Roger. He was with us back in December of 2016, and we're delighted to have him back. 10 years ago, faculty from the School of Computing and the Division of Film Studies formed the Entertainment Arts and Engineering, EAE, program to address a growing student population that wanted to study games and game making. Today, EAE is number one in the world for public universities in game development and interactive entertainment. Roger Altizer, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here again.
Well, it's great to have you back on the program, Roger. And it's also encouraging to see VR, virtual reality, and games moving from an entertainment-only experience to educational and medical digital therapies. And maybe we can start by you telling us about the landmark decision this summer by the FDA.
Certainly. It's an exciting time to be in serious games or games for health. The FDA making the decision that we can prescribe video games or digital therapeutics changes the landscape. It opens up the door for all sorts of awesome startups and cool things happening at universities to now be prescribed to you as a therapy. So in the very near future, your doctor might give you a prescription for a video game instead of a pill.
Yeah, that's just very exciting. And the article that was in the Trib, the Salt Lake Tribune, goes through some of the applications. Maybe you can tell us about one of them.
Certainly. There's one we're working at Utah that's really exciting. It's called NeuroGrow. There are a lot of older adults who find themselves treatment resistant with depression, meaning that as they age, their antidepressants might not work, or they might not start working if they just get on them. We've got researchers up there being led by Shizuko Morimoto, who've proven that there are games and activities that you can play that will enhance the ability of your antidepressants to start working. So the brain continues to be plastic into advanced age, and this allows you to sort of loosen things up and get medications to start working again.
That's fascinating. It may be a bit of a tie-in with our next interview, in which we're talking about the link between science and the subconscious mind. It seems like these games that you're designing are sort of priming the mind to accept medication in a more effective way.
That's a great way to describe it. And there's a lot of applications for this, from mental health to physical therapy, especially at a time like now. You can imagine that clinicians are going to want you to do physical therapy at home, and prescribing you a physical therapy video game could be a good way of doing it.
Absolutely. I have to say, Roger, that I was surprised when I looked up your name, and the first hit that came up was how you belong to the School of Medicine as a games designer. And, you know, what a beautiful collaboration, right?
It is not the twist I expected my career to take, but it has been an exciting one. When I first started doing medical games and apps, several years ago, I thought it would just be a thing I got to do as a professor. But Utah Health was really excited about it, and now we have a lab with 30 students working with doctors all over the place, or with clinicians, doctors, nurses, researchers, on all sorts of medical games and apps.
What are some of the anti-anxiety benefits to some of the games, people that are suffering from anxiety?
Yeah, sure. It's one of the things I talk about at the Therapeutic Games and Apps Lab a lot, or the GAP Lab. It's this notion that people are their best when they are at play. And if you think about it, when you look back at your childhood or even recently, if you've been from playing tennis to playing tag, those situations can be stressful, but they're not anxiety-inducing in the way that people want to avoid. And so what we find is for a lot of people, play is a great way of dealing with anxiety. This all started years ago. There was a research study out of Michigan that showed that playing Bejeweled, which is a game kind of like Candy Crush, had the same effects as low-dose drugs like Xanax. So there's something about playing games, especially puzzle games, but pretty much games in general, that allow the mind to put things in order, check things off their lists. The brain is very excited when you're playing a game in ways that are different from a book or movie, and that seems to have some good anti-anxiety properties. And so we're just scratching the surface on, can we specifically target things like anxiety or depression with video games? And our early research shows that we can indeed. But I think that anyone would tell you who plays a lot of games that one of the reasons they do it is because it's not only really engaging, but it's also really relaxing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Roger Altizer. And Roger, I just want to give you a little better introduction. You're a PhD. You're director of the Therapeutic Games and Apps Lab. You're the director of digital medicine from the Center for Medical Innovation. You're also an associate professor, and you co-founded Entertainment Arts and Engineering. You've got a lot going on there, don't you?
I've been at Utah for a hot minute, and it's been a good ride.
Yeah.
The university's been very supportive of innovation.
Yeah, and I think I remember you saying, and I'm trying to think who said this, but it's something along the lines, show me what kids are playing, and I'll tell you about the future. Was that something that you said?
I sure hope it is, because it sounds really good, but I think it might have been someone smarter than me.
Roger.
But it's completely true. I think that that young adults, I frequently... I have this phrase when people are a bit worried. I go, don't worry about it. Kids are cool. They've got this. It's amazing what the millennials and the zennials are coming up with and all the amazing things they're doing online. It's we're sort of living that now with our lives on Zoom. And I think that if we patterned ourselves after what they're doing on Twitch and with esports and the rest, I think we'd probably be a lot better at it.
Yeah. Roger, I'm going to expose myself as a non-gamer, and I'm a little bit ashamed to even admit what I'm about to, which is down at the local burger shop, Devanza's. They've got a Pac-Man machine in their game. And when you talk about games taking the anxiety level down, I feel like when I play that Pac-Man game, because I'm just so bad at the joystick or whatever it is, I feel nothing but stress. And so I was sort of cracking up when you were talking about that. But, talk about how good game design will produce some of these emotional or psychological effects that you want, such as, lowered anxiety. And, Pac-Man, can we really count that in there as good game design?
Yeah, it's funny. There's a statement about Pac-Man that's disputed, but it's a fun one to say nonetheless, that because of both Space Invaders and then Pac-Man, we ran out of quarters. And they had to make more quarters, right?
Yeah.
And those games were enormously popular. And I think one of the reasons is because it's the right kind of stress and it's the right kind of anxiety. I think very few people experience those games and are really, truly calm, right? They're exciting experiences, and they're short, which gets you to keep putting quarters in them again and again. So if you think about the magic of Pac-Man or Space Invaders for a minute, it's this idea that I can put a box in a bar or an arcade or a donut shop. I can make it a very difficult task. It'll stress you out, and you're going to pay to do it, right?
Yeah.
And people paid millions and millions of quarters went into these machines. And to this day, that still tends to be the experience. So I think that we're finally getting to a more nuanced understanding of stress, right, or pressure in ways that are actually good for us, in ways that we enjoy, right, as opposed to just being stressed out. But also, I tell you, I'm not alone. I was less stressed out by Pac-Man, but Miss Pac-Man gave me a run for my money because it was always changing and got me stressed out as well.
So. That's great. So in your profile, you talk about these two types of games. You talk about medical games, which you've talked about already, and then there's this thing called serious games. What is a serious game?
Yeah, that's a great question. Serious games, or another term that's really popular for it, is games for change, is a pretty simple notion, and it's, can we use games for something other than just entertainment? Not that it will exclude entertainment, but it has another purpose, right? So it could be a game for fitness. It could be a game to teach you about the federal budget. It could be a game to reduce your anxiety. All of these things we would sort of qualify as serious games. And then in the games for change category, you also get a lot of social impact games, where it's what is it like to understand the life of another person? So one of the more famous one is Darfur is Dying, about the crisis in Darfur. And there's a lot of great games in that category as well. But this notion that, and I frequently talk to people about this, that this notion that we can be playful instead of workful in our approaches to certain things. Some things are just going to be hard work. They're just going to be labor. But there's a certain beauty, and I think a certain amount of letting people be engaged with being playful with your education or playful with your health, right? And I think it's the same link for both. I gave a talk at Snowbird back in the days when we could give talks at Snowbird to a bunch of health sciences leaders from around the nation. And it was a fancy talk. And so it's in a room that overlooks the ski hill, right? People are skiing. And the talk was about, why are people not participating in their physical therapy, right? You have massive numbers of people who drop out of their physical therapy, like 70%, depending on the type of therapy. And I'm all, but look out the window. It's cold, but people have spent a lot of money to come up here and ski, and they're doing everything you want. It's physical, it's social, it's voluntary, and it's because there's a sense of agency and playfulness to it. Like, if you think about skiing, it's a lot of work. You got to put on special equipment. It's cold. You have to learn a skill. But we're willing to overcome all of that in the name of fun and to participate in a culture. And games are that way, too. So if we can say, if doing your math or doing your physical therapy isn't just about work, abstract labor, but it's part of a culture and it's something you have some choice in and it's fun, I think it's like skiing. I think people are more likely to do it.
Roger, what do brain scans tell us about cerebral activity between a passive activity like watching TV or a movie and an active activity like gaming?
That's a great question. We actually got our first fMRI scan of somebody playing a game with the game Remission, which was a game designed by Hope Labs for kids fighting cancer. And what it showed us was the brain is just on fire when you're playing a video game. So they compared it to watching movies, and we've seen similar results with books. Passive engagement is different than active engagement. And when you're solving problems, it's a different thing than when you're consuming media. And we see that in the scan, that all the motivation centers of the brain are just on fire because you're making choices and you're seeing rewards for those choices. Even a simple game like Super Mario Brothers, right? When you just make Mario run to the right, like you'll notice some kids when they're playing the game, they're not even trying to beat it or finish it. They're just running around and jumping and getting a coin here or there, maybe even dying on purpose. And all of that is because it's fun. It's fun because the brain says, oh, look, there's something on a screen. I want Mario to go right. It pushes the thumb pad down with your thumb. Mario moves to the right. The brain says, oh my gosh, I did that thing. And then it's nonstop. You want to do a thing, the thing immediately happens, and the brain loves it. And of course, it's colorful and bright, and it's cultural and has good music. And so that gets everyone engaged as well. But yeah, the mind loves games, from board games to video games. And so there's some real opportunities to do good stuff there.
Yeah, tell us about some applications for training. Lynn and I had the Tetris ski and sailboat folks on a couple of times, and I understand that you provide the VR simulation that helps people who are paralyzed to learn to ski and sail by controlling everything from their mouth. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The Trails program is a beautiful program, getting people with spinal cord injuries to ski and sail again. I mean, what's better than that, right? So what we did was we sort of said, there's got to be a way to train people to do these complex activities that they might not get to do very often. As you can imagine, if you have a spinal cord injury, they've made it really easy to sail. They've removed a lot of barriers to it, but you might only get to do it once in a year, a couple of times a year, or for some people, once in a lifetime, and they really want to get the most out of it. So we made game-like simulators that use the same controls, a sip and puff controller in your mouth or a joystick to let you control a virtual sailboat or ski down a virtual hill. And we even modeled the hill after Alta, so it's pretty realistic. And so those training experiences, we can simulate what those things look like. And that's of interest to lots of people. At Utah, we're working on VR surgery simulators right now. We have a great project that's going to go public in October called Virtual Home Sim. And it's a tool designed to help social workers who are going to be entering people's home assess them for protective and not protective measures to determine if a home is safe for a child. One of the things that happens is when you're a young social worker, it's hard to overcome your biases, right? And so when you enter a home that might be messy, for example, and you came from a clean home, you might say, oh, this home, it might be dangerous for a child. But in reality, it depends on the kind of mess. If there's lots of homework assignments taped to the walls, if the mess is largely children's clothes and toys, or if there's good food around, that might be a wonderful, happy, healthy environment for a kid. It's just messy. So we made a virtual reality trainer where we go into homes of all sorts, from all sorts of different socioeconomic situations, that allow us to look around those homes, and then you look at things and you say, that's a good thing for a kid, or that's a dangerous thing for a kid. And then we had expert social workers do it. So when novice social workers do it, they get a report at the end that tells them, you said this was dangerous. Expert social workers actually say that's a safe thing, or vice versa. And it's a really cool training opportunity. Those experiences are very hard to do in real life. What they normally did was they rent a theater and hire actors and set up a fake home, and then a social worker gets one shot at it. And then they go out into the real world and they have to be social workers. This allows them to visit all sorts of homes, really an infinite number of homes if we can film them, and get trained by some of the best social workers in the nation. So they get to not only practice, but we can give them lessons like, hey, if there's vodka in a home and it's near the nightstand, that's a different thing than if it's in the freezer.
Wow. So useful. And I think we're seeing this more and more, and especially at the University of Utah. You know, some months ago, we spoke with Mark Durham, who is in the School of Dentistry at the University of Utah. I would imagine that you work with him some on his VR projects, where he's training dental students to go in and do a, you know, whatever type of dental procedure, where you do the same step in the procedure over and over and over. You go inside a molar to, you know, kind of see and feel and, you know, what it would be like to perform a root canal. Talk to us about that a little bit. That's such exciting work.
Isn't it? And that's really expanding. There's a new center being developed at Utah for experiential learning with Dr. Wendy Hobson-Rohr, Mark Durham, myself, the Eccles Health Sciences Library, Center for Medical Innovation, all sorts of folk. And the real goal is those kinds of experiences. Can we do those across the curriculum? So you don't have to wait for a rare disease to come into the hospital to treat it. You can learn it through virtual reality. And these tools, like I said, they're really valuable. We need to do a lot of remote learning like we're doing during this time with the novel coronavirus. But those opportunities are fascinating because it's not only a simulator. You can simulate, for example, like you were talking about, a procedure on a tooth or an appendectomy or intubating a young adult. You can simulate those things, but you can also break it up into smaller chunks. you can increase and decrease the difficulty, and you can do things that are impossible in real life. So if you want to, for example, show what's blocking an airway, you could have someone go into the throat and see what's blocking that airway. So you have the full spectrum of opportunity of doing realistic training as well as abstract training in one software application. And people really engage it. Virtual reality is very powerful because it not only simulates reality, and of course it's not reality, it's just a simulation of reality, but it also gives us a chance to do things that we don't expect, like focus. So for example, I've had lots of students and patients that I've worked with, when they put on the headset, they can focus on a task because literally there's no distractions. You see nothing but this. Like even when you're looking at your computer monitor, there's all sorts of stuff around you. But when you put on a virtual reality headset, you are in that space. And time flies, right? You really are able to focus, whether that's for fun or for training.
We're speaking with University of Utah professor Roger Altizer. He's in the Entertainment Arts and Engineering program and also the medical school. Obviously, as he's talking about all of this, the blending of technology with medical education, it is truly incredible. One thing I noticed under your profile, Roger, was a type of game that would help women, pregnant women, decide, you know, make decisions about what, where they were going in their prenatal, I don't know, treatment, or help me out with this. I just thought this is wild.
Yeah, it's a space you don't expect games to be in at all. So we're doing lots of things with pregnancy, with genetics, with fitness. One of our apps that's really cool is called You Baby Fit. It's a collaboration with the Department of Nursing, and it's for women who are pregnant to help avoid pre-gestational diabetes. And what's important about these kinds of games is not only is the topic and the science and the medicine important, but the process is important. Anytime you make a game for someone it is very unlikely that I will become pregnant, much less experience pre-gestational diabetes in my lifetime. That being said, one of the things we like to do is to invite patients and experts in the field into the design process of those kinds of apps, right? So You Baby Fit then doesn't get designed in a way like something that I think is cool, right? There's no robots or flying saucers or anything like that in it. It's going to be the way that expecting parents think is cool. And so for genetic testing of the fetus, we allow parents to come in and do design sessions with us, and then we make clinical decision aid tools or advice tools for them where they can sort of playfully explore what their options are. Do they want genetic tests? When do they want genetic tests? Which ones are optional? What will they tell you? And they get to explore that in a small game-like environment and make decisions about if they want to do prenatal genetic testing or not.
I want to mention that at the beginning of the conversation, we were talking about some studies and trials going on for potential depression treatments. And I want to mention, if any of our listeners out there would like to possibly participate in one of those trials, they could call Dr. Sarah Mortimoto's clinic at 801-581-3353. And Roger, do they still have trials going on, I'm assuming?
Yeah, we are getting ramped up on that, and we just put in another grant for another trial. So we're super excited about getting participants in that.
Yeah. When do you think we'll be able to buy off-the-shelf games that will really contribute to our cognitive decline? Not contribute to decline, but contribute to helping us get some stuff back?
Well, I think you asked the question right both times. I get a lot of parents who are very concerned about what video games are doing to their kids' brains. So I spend a fair amount of time reassuring them. And actually, the easiest way that I do is I introduce them to some of our students, and they're just remarkable young people who are just brilliant and making amazing things. And they've played a lot of video games. So if they're okay, your kid's probably going to be okay as well. But I think that that's actually a really interesting question. There are a lot of games out there for cognitive decline, or like you see memory games. You see a lot of products out there that purport to be good for the brain exercise kinds of games. The first one that caught a lot of people's attention was back in the day on the Nintendo DS called Brain Age. And it had a virtual doctor, and you did math problems and word problems, and allegedly it would show you your brain age. And so, like, for example, I'm 46, and if I played the game, maybe I'd have the brain of a 36-year-old. But a lot of that is not necessarily clinically validated. And so while there are lots of things out there that you can buy right now, brain video games and memory trainers, we're only just starting to see ones that have been put through clinical trials, rigorous clinical trials, to prove that they actually work. So much in the same way as medicine is, people can make nutraceuticals, things that are made out of food, and they don't get regulated in the same way that prescription medications do. The same is now true of software, where a lot of people can say this game will be good for you or this software will help your brain. But in reality, it hasn't been clinically validated. And that's why we're excited about the FDA decision and then all the great kind of work that's happening all over the world, really, with clinicians who are trying to prove what actually makes games work and which ones can we actually prescribe to help you.
Roger Altizer, he's University of Utah professor and also was a founder of the EAE, Entertainment Arts and Engineering, and of course the Gap Lab, which is getting a lot of attention. We want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to. It's anything we can do to sort of talk to people about games and games for health and encourage people to live a playful, happy life is something I'm always down for.
All right. Yeah. Thanks, Roger.
Okay. Thank you, Roger.
Of course. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute. We'll be right back.